hotels and guest houses are currently being occupied by Ukrainian refugees. There's concern the bloc's tourism sector will be decimated this summer if the issue is not resolved. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The largest biogas plant in Iran is under construction in the city of Mashhad. Biogas is a type of renewable fuel produced after organic waste, such as food scraps and agricultural waste, is decomposed in an oxygen-free environment, producing gases such as methane, which can be converted into electricity. Mashhad biogas plant will generate more than 22,000 megawatts of electricity per year.
At first glance, garbage is all about expenses associated with its collection, dumping and burying. By using cutting-edge technologies in biogas system, we can generate energy from waste. We will transfer the gases produced in our landfills to the biogas plant and burn them to generate electricity.
Biogas is a mixture of gases produced in landfills, primarily consisting of methane, carbon dioxide, and hydrogen sulfide. Since biogas technology will consume all these gases to produce energy, it will prevent the emission of large quantities of toxic gases like methane and CO2.
Methane is highly detrimental to the environment. Some experts say it is 200 times more contaminating than carbon dioxide, but the good news is it can be turned into electricity. So when we launch this plant next year, we'll breathe cleaner air with less methane emissions.
Every year, some 30 million visitors arrive in Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. This has made the bustling megacity the second in Iran after the capital Tehran to produce the most waste, with 2,000 tons of garbage generated every day. With biogas technology now available, more trash means more energy.
Each cubic meter of biogas with 60% methane content converts to 6.7 kilowatt hours energy. So the large amount of waste produced daily in Mashhad can be utilized efficiently to generate clean energy.
Mashhad already has a smaller biogas plant built on a landfill at the edge of the city. For now, authorities say biogas systems account for a small portion of electricity generated in the city. They're planning to turn biogas into one of the main energy sources with the aim of promoting the use of green fuels.
Now that biogas is seen as a viable source of energy that's both renewable and eco-friendly, Mashhad municipality says the emerging technology needs to dominate conventional methods of energy production. The city is now planning to build more biogas plants, which can both optimize waste management and produce clean energy. Yusuf Jalali, Mashhad.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said Syria is keen on maintaining continuous coordination with Iran, especially now amid rapid regional and international developments. He reiterated that Syria will not press ahead with talks with Turkey unless the goal was to end Turkish occupation in Syria and the support of terrorist organizations. Abdullahian said any serious dialogue between Syria and Turkey is a positive step for both countries and the region, expressing Iran's trust in Syria's stances and decisions. The top Iranian diplomat held separate talks with his Syrian counterpart, Faisal al-Maqdad, focusing on expanding economic and trade relations between both countries. In a joint press conference, Abdullahian touched upon Syrian-Iranian economic ties.
Our relations with Syria are at their best condition. We must exert our utmost efforts to boost economic ties to the level of our political ones. We agreed to prepare a long-term strategic cooperation document to be signed in the near future.
He indicated to Iran's role in preventing a planned Turkish military operation in northern Syria, welcoming diplomatic efforts for ending disputes between the two neighbors. Miqdad said the visit comes at a critical time amid challenges facing Syria.
The visit comes as we face challenges set by the U.S., the West, Israel and their proxies. They don't want the Syrian people to heal. Our relations with Iran are strategic and soon there will be steps taken that prove the depth of relations and both countries believe in the necessity of enhancing them.
Miqdad said Syria will not forget the repeated Israeli aggressions, promising at the right time Syria will respond and inflict heavy losses on Israel in a way it will regret all its attacks. Amir Abdullahian's visit is part of a regional tour aimed at evaluating developments with Iran's allies. It's a reminder of the strong ties among member states of the resistance alliance, despite decades-long attempts to break them by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Flowers, gifts, and poems. In Iran, it is once again the time of the year to celebrate women, their progress, and their victories. Traditionally, 1 week is designated as Women's Week in Iran, which includes the birthday of Hazrat Fatimah, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, celebrated as Mother's Day.
The days of Women's Week have been named as follows. After Friday, which is of course Mother's Day, the day of women and their role in the family, Saturday is named Women and Virtue, Resisting Western Patriarchy, Sunday, Women and Self-Esteem, Leaders in Scientific Fields, Monday, Women, Creators of the Next Generation, Tuesday, Women, Buoyant, Resourceful and Wise, Wednesday, Women, Security and Social Justice, and Thursday, Women, Hopeful and Faithful.
But this year, Iranians are celebrating Women's Week, while under U.S. pressure, the Islamic Republic was removed from the United Nations Women's Commission, and as foreign-backed rioters have tried to exploit the concept of women and their freedom for their own political gains. So I asked the Vice President how women's status has changed over the past four decades.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, women were given more opportunities to take on social roles. Women literacy has increased from 35% four decades ago to 95% today. More than 60% of university students and 30% of faculty members and professors are women. We have over 2,700 NGOs, mostly run by women.
An issue that was also raised by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution in a special meeting arranged to honor Women's Week. But most importantly, the leader pointed to the fact that solidarity is key, and the issue of hijab should not be exploited to divide women. Women who were present chanted slogans to show that they agree with the leader, and this is what's highlighted Women's Week this year.
The occasion this year is of more significance than ever before. It has become an opportunity to shed light on the fact that the recent foreign-backed riots and the exploitation of women to divide the country was a failed attempt by Iran's enemies. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
The UK's rogue royal, Prince Harry, has come under fire both at home and abroad, after admitting he killed 25 Afghans during his military service. In his highly controversial memoir, Spare, Harry claims he killed 25 people during his two tours of occupied Afghanistan, adding he didn't think of them as people, but instead as chess pieces that had been taken off the board.
Harry served as an attack helicopter pilot between 2012 and 2013. The book alleges that all the targets were combatants. However, following furious protests from inside Afghanistan, many British establishment critics have condemned the revelation, believing that it creates a new and unnecessary security threat against his own family members.
Amid the condemnation, British Muslims feel particularly outraged.
I don't think Harry should be silenced for what he said. In fact, I think he should be encouraged to go into more detail about the ideology and the training that's being pumped into British soldiers. It's not even the first time that he's likened killing humans with playing games. In 2013, he said it was a joy to use his controller during airstrikes. He said it was like playing a PlayStation or an Xbox.
Afghans are also furious, with many, including Taliban officials, issuing demands for Harry to be put on trial for war crimes.
The consensus in Afghanistan, and amongst probably Muslim opinion all around the world, is that he was involved in a war where hundreds of thousands of innocent Afghans were killed, a nation was destroyed, millions were displaced, and therefore he is a war criminal who should be accounted for his crimes. I run a British Muslim website, and we did an online poll the other day, and it had about 5,000 votes. It was a one-day poll, and 85% of our readers and viewers said that Prince Harry was a war criminal. And that's because Muslims, you know, we consider ourselves one body. And if one part of the body hurts, the whole of the body hurts.
Many British Muslims are left questioning how they now view a royal family with Muslim blood on its hands. Robert Carter, London.
One more Palestinian was shot dead early Thursday by Israeli soldiers, this time during a raid in Qalandia refugee camp north of Al-Quds. 41-year-old Samir Aslan was killed only minutes after his 17-year-old son Ramzi was arrested by the Israeli soldiers from their home. Aslan, with other family members, went to the roof of their home to watch what was going on, but a sniper shot him in the chest and soldiers prevented his family members to transfer him to hospital until he died.
A large number of Israeli forces stormed Qalandia refugee camp and detained some 20 Palestinians. Then they headed to the home of the martyr to arrest his son Ramzi. The whole family went up to the roof to see what was happening when they heard loud screams, when an Israeli sniper opened fire and shot Samir directly in the chest.
After Samir was shot, his sons carried him down to transfer him to hospital, but the Israeli soldiers dragged him and put him on the ground and prevented anyone to rescue him. They left only after they made sure Samir succumbed to his injuries. This is a field execution.
Samir Aslan is the third Palestinian killed in the occupied West Bank in the last 24 hours. Israeli forces killed 18-year-old Sanad Samamri following an alleged stabbing attack in the southern occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. On Wednesday, 21-year-old Ahmed Junaid was shot dead in the head during a military raid on the Balata refugee camp in Nablus, north of the occupied West Bank.
The continuation of these raids and campaigns means that this current Israeli cabinet will continue the aggressive policies against the Palestinians in a bid to fight resistance and prevent any form of activity in the occupied West Bank.
Tensions have been running high in the occupied Palestinian territories since last year. Nearly 180 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone in 2022. The United Nations said death toll was the highest since 2006 in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military's brutality shows no sign of abating and is cracking down on Palestinian fighters as well as the general population here. Palestinians warn of even more aggressive policies by Israel's current right-wing regime led by Benjamin Netanyahu. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The National Women's Day in Iran does not coincide with the international occasion, as it is designated on the birth anniversary of a highly revered woman in Islam, Lady Fatima. Also known as Zahra, Hazrat Fatima was the daughter of Prophet Muhammad and the wife of Imam Ali, the first Shia Imam. Here, in the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the eighth Shia Imam in the city of Mashhad, Muslims from Iran and other countries gathered to celebrate the festive occasion.
I congratulate all Muslims on the birthday anniversary of Hazrat Fatima. Lady Fatima is an example of piety, compassion, and generosity. The Prophet Muhammad regarded her as the best of women. He kissed her hand in public to show the high status of women at a time when female children were seen as a disgrace.
Still, after 14 centuries, Muslims speak highly of Hazrat Fatima. Muslim women view her as a role model.
Hazrat Fatima made great contributions to the promotion of Islamic teachings. Fatima is extolled and praised in the Book of Quran in a surah called Kawthar, which tells Prophet Muhammad that God has given you Fatima as a gift.
Iranians' love for the daughter of Prophet Muhammad goes beyond these celebrations. Many families name their daughters after her. And that's why Fatima and Zahra are the most common names among Iranian women, including this lady who has asked her fiancé to start their marriage on the birthday of Lady Fatima.
My name is Zahra. My parents named me after Lady Zahra, and I'm so grateful for that. She is an inspirational figure. That's why my husband and I decided to start our marriage on the auspicious occasion of her birthday.
Lady Fatima's name went down in history as an alpha female who continues to inspire Muslim women to date. Iranian seers say they celebrate Women's Day on Hazrat Fatima's birthday to shed light on the inner beauty of women and their pivotal role in building a better family and better society. Mashhad.
Sana is dying. She was born just a few days ago, but because of a rare birth malformation, doctors believe she only has a few days to live. Sana is one of the thousands of Yemeni babies facing a similar fate. Here in the Sab'een Hospital in the Yemeni capital, doctors say they have been receiving birth defect cases at an alarming rate since 2015. That's when the Saudi-led coalition launched its war on Yemen. Doctors here are convinced that biological weapons were employed by the Saudis.
We've received many birth defect cases throughout the years. However, this is the first time we received a case like this. She does not have the bottom limbs or kidneys or even a urinary tract or liver. She's missing all of her bottom half organs. Malformation cases have risen significantly since 2015. We believe the rise in these cases is due to the hazardous poisons from the weapons being used in the war.
Cancer cases are also on the rise. The spokesperson for Yemen's Ministry of Health says that the data and statistics recorded since the war started indicate that biological weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition are the main cause of the steady increase in cancer and birth defects.
These cases are rising in the areas that were targeted by illegal weapons in a number of provinces in Yemen, which has led to a significant increase of various kinds of cancer cases and also birth defects and miscarriages. It was never like this prior to the war.
We visited the registration office at Yemen's only oncology center. It was packed with people pushing their way to register for cancer treatment.
I am here to register for medication. I have oral cancer.
I have just received another case. The person who just registered is from Ebb and has liver cancer.
According to Yemen's Ministry of Health, the number of cancer patients increased by more than 50% since the war was launched in 2015. The Yemeni Ministry of Health says it will form a committee to officially investigate the main cause for the increase in birth defects and cancer cases in the areas that have been hit the most by the Saudi airstrikes. Even if it's evident that prohibited weapons were utilized by Saudi Arabia and its coalition forces, it is unlikely they will face prosecution, since most of the weapons used in the war are supplied by the American and British governments.
Doctors and medical experts say the increase in cancer and birth defect cases is rooted in the eight-year Saudi-led war that has polluted Yemen's air, water, and food. They blame the Saudi-led coalition's use of prohibited weapons such as biological weapons, toxic gases, and cluster bombs. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A
official statistics show that the number of homeless people in London, England, has increased significantly due to increase in the cost of living. According to official statistics, the number of people living on the streets of London has increased by 24%. Britain's economy has faced many challenges in recent years. The exit of Britain from the European Union and the expenses caused by the control of the coronavirus pandemic and government incompetence have all contributed to the current economic crisis. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Metro website has covered this story and tells us more. According to new data, homelessness rate in London was higher than the national rate for England in 2022. Shelter says 1 in 58 people in London were sleeping rough last year, with London's borough councils describing the figures as devastating. The charity Shelter said it is expecting a sharp rise in homelessness in 2023, while local authorities call on the government to ensure changes are made amid the cost of living crisis. Shelter's chief executive, Polly Neat, said, "The new year should be a time of hope, but this isn't the case for the 271,000 homeless people who are facing a truly bleak 2023. Polly Neat added, "A cold doorway or a grotty hostel room is not a home, but this is a reality for too many people today. Our frontline advisors are working to help people who are desperate to escape homelessness, from the parents doing all they can to provide some shred of a normal family life while stuck in an emergency bed and breakfast, to a person terrified of another night sleeping rough." Polly Neat said, "With private rents and living costs continuing to soar, thousands of people are not just facing a winter of worry, they're at risk of losing the roof over their head." Polly Neat added, "At Shelter, we are bracing ourselves for a sharp rise in homelessness in 2023. More than ever, we'll be relying on the public's generosity to help us support and campaign for all those fighting for a safe home." Figures from the charity show that the rate of homelessness in London last year was nearly three times higher than England as a whole, which saw 1 in 208 on the streets. Councillor Darren Rodwell, London Council's executive member for Regeneration, Housing and Planning, said these devastating figures reveal that London remains the epicentre of the homelessness crisis in Britain. Darren Rodwell added, "Everyone deserves a permanent home, but the chronic shortage of affordable housing in the capital means too many Londoners find themselves homeless and reliant on temporary accommodation arranged by their local council. The numbers are so high that they're equivalent to the entire population of a London borough." The website of Inside Housing has also covered the same story. According to new research by Shelter, 1 in 100 children in England are homeless and living in temporary accommodation. Shelter's analysis found that 26% of the parents of the 120,710 children reported their children are unhappy or depressed as a result of living in temporary accommodation, while many are forced to share beds. Shelter expects the number of homeless children to grow as the cost of living crisis deepens the housing emergency. Recently, Inside Housing's research revealed that more than 26,000 children under the age of 5 are homeless and living in temporary accommodation in England. Temporary accommodation, which can take the form of emergency hostels, bed and breakfast, one-room bedsits and cramped flats, is provided by councils to eligible families who become homeless. It is not designed as permanent accommodation, and families can be asked to move numerous times on short notice. The latest government data shows that 5,030 families are living in emergency bed and breakfast and hostel rooms, widely considered the worst type of temporary accommodation. Shelter study, the largest ever conducted and funded by Trust for London and the Joseph Rantree Foundation, involved more than 800 families with 1,600 children living in temporary accommodation throughout England. It looked at the impact of temporary accommodation on children's health, on children's well-being and education. It found that more than a third, or 35%, of homeless parents say their child or their children do not have a bed of their own and must share with another family member. Almost half, or 45%, of school-age children have arrived at school tired, late or hungry as a result of living in temporary accommodation. Bed and breakfast and hostels are often not equipped with suitable or any facilities for parents to cook meals, and noise from other residents and bed sharing mean children often struggle to sleep. Parents reported that just over 60% of children lack space to play in their temporary accommodation. One in four parents, or about 28%, said their children are finding it hard to make or keep friends as a result of living in temporary accommodation. This can be because they're embarrassed or ashamed of where they live, because they're unable to have friends over to play due to a lack of space or rules that forbid visitors. Sky News has also covered the same story and tells us more. A Scottish charity has raised the alarm about the potential of a notable rise in the death rate among the homeless in Scotland as the entire United Kingdom grapples with a worsening economic crisis. The Simon Community Charity issued the warning as Scotland is still reeling from hundreds of homeless deaths that were registered last year. The network reported recent official figures from the National Records of Scotland reveal an estimated 250 homeless people died last year, which is around 50% higher than in 2017. Lorraine McGrath, the charity's chief executive, said it is a worsening position over the last 3 to 4 years, which is a massive concern. Lorraine McGrath added, "The vast majority of these people are under the age of 45, adding that is because of the massive health inequalities they face and the stress on their body that leads to premature aging, that in turn leads to long-term conditions that may well be easily treatable." Lorraine McGrath added, "People experiencing homelessness don't enjoy the same access to healthcare, which increases their risk of early death." Britain's year-on-year inflation rate stands at 10.7%, the highest in four decades. Meanwhile, the inflationary spiral is growing at a much faster pace than the average wage rise across the country. Food prices have skyrocketed almost 20%. Rising energy prices, along with soaring energy costs, have also largely contributed to Britain's cost-of-living crisis. Many labour unions have launched industrial action to press the government to enact wage hikes. The government, however, refuses to increase the wages, saying it would increase inflation. The government blames the economic doldrums partly on the COVID-19 pandemic, saying the country had been having a hard time recovering from the stagnation that used to govern the period. Experts, however, fault leadership incompetence and turbulence that saw the country changing several prime ministers over the past 2 years.
This one lay. Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. The focus of the protests is how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the Supreme Court's power in its own favor. Now, Netanyahu is also the focus of these protests since he is trying to escape bribery, fraud, and the breach of trust charges. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the inner workings of the Israeli regime and how it's unraveling, and whether the prediction by the former Israeli Prime Minister, Ehud Barak, is coming true, that Israel will cease to exist before its 80th anniversary. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Nico Pellet, author and human rights activist, joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us, Charlotte Cates, international coordinator, Samidun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joins us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Mikko Pellet, let me first start with you and just get a reaction. These are unprecedented numbers from what we understand. 80,000 Israelis have turned out. We're looking at Haifa, Al-Quds, and Tel Aviv, where they showed up. And your reaction as to why in such numbers they have come out to protest, and what you think about the reasoning behind the protest that they have chanted.
You know, well, thank you for having me. You know, I think that Israelis like to live in this reality where they are a privileged society within a larger apartheid regime. And their fear right now, the fear of Israeli society and most of the people that we see coming out to protest, is that their privilege within that reality might be infringed somehow. And that's why we're seeing such high numbers. I think we would be, you know, it would be a mistake to think that these very large numbers are out there because they care about, you know, about the Palestinians, or that they are somehow coming out against the oppression and the killing and the inevitable disaster that is going to come up upon Palestinians as a result of this government. And so, you know, Israelis are used to living in a very privileged life politically and socially and economically. And they are, I think, worried that this particular government may, and they may be right, may be infringing on some of those privileges. And so they're out in big numbers. Israelis also are not happy with Netanyahu's choices, because the people he chose to put in key positions, very sensitive security-related positions, and education-related positions, and finance-related positions, are people who are thugs, who are racist, violent thugs. The names like, you know, Itamar Ben-Gvir comes up a lot, Bezalel Smotrich comes up a lot. And so these are people that the Israeli society are quite embarrassed to have among them, to see them in positions of power, because they are thugs. And Israel would rather see these people as, or view them as an insignificant minority, where in fact they're not. Obviously now they're in places where they wield a great power. So I think that's what this is about. I do think also that the people around the world, though, that the international community needs to stand up for the Palestinians, which is what Israeli society is not doing, is failing to do. Israeli, I think the international community needs to demand the safety and security, or guarantees for the safety and security of Palestinians, because the lives of Palestinians, of every Palestinian from this moment on, is in imminent danger. I think what we've seen in the past 75 years is nothing compared to what is about to happen.
All right, let's take a look at the sounds as is coming off the streets, Charlotte Cates, as to why people have come out to protest there in Israel. One of the reasons is this proposal to change the country's judicial system. Now, Netanyahu has made that his focus, based on what we understand, and wants to make some legal changes, of which he wants to basically, if you want to call it reforms, but reforms in a way that are going to make the long end of it short here, to decrease the power of, I guess, of the courts in favor of whatever it is that Netanyahu and his cabinet want to enact. Now, that could be very dangerous. What are your thoughts on that, and how maybe in one sense that could also overlap into the way that Palestinians are dealt with?
Sure. Well, just to say that from the beginning, the so-called Israeli civil court system has never been a civil system for Palestinians, and that includes Palestinians in occupied Palestine 48, as well as Palestinians living under occupation in the West Bank and Gaza and Jerusalem. You know, there's Palestinians under occupation throughout occupied Palestine, the entirety of historic Palestine. The court system has always functioned as a weapon and a tool of the Zionist project as such, as the overall Zionist project. And so even court rulings that have been viewed as in some way providing more rights or protections to Palestinians in regard to torture do so only within the context specifically of preserving Zionism. And one of the things that's happening is that we're seeing this breach about what it means to preserve Zionism, because there is this Zionist narrative of the Israeli occupation regime being a liberal democracy. And what this government is doing and what its demands for change are in the judicial realm are helping to expose the reality that Palestinians have been living with for 75 years on a daily basis, which is that this sham of liberal democracy is built on the dispossession of Palestinians and the expropriation of their land and property. And so this conflict over the future of the court, you know, isn't really a battle between, you know, people's rights and democracy versus the, you know, dictatorship of Netanyahu and, you know, authoritarianism versus democracy. It's about what is the best way to sell Zionism to the population and to the world at large. And what the actions of this government are helping to expose the reality of Zionism that has always existed under the liberal cloaking that is provided by these judicial authorities. And certainly there are many Israelis who are part of the Zionist system that are not willing to confront that reality.
Yes, this notion of democracy needs to be covered a little bit more here. Ami Kopelat, I'd like to ask you, based on what Charlotte Cates there said, again, based on her statement there, has the notion of democracy for Israelis come, first of all, at the expense of Palestinians in the way that their rights were violated? Because this notion of democracy is argued by opposition and the people who are opposed to that notion that Israel, as an apartheid regime, cannot have that notion of democracy exist within its parameters, so to speak. Is that a correct viewpoint to address this issue of democracy in Israel?
Well, Israel is an apartheid regime, so an apartheid regime can't be a democracy. However, if you are on the privileged side of the apartheid regime, you enjoy rights that the other side does not. So I, as an Israeli, if I'm in, you know, when I'm there as a citizen, I enjoy rights that my Palestinian friends do not enjoy. And for Israelis, by and large, the state of Israel is quite, you know, is like a liberal democracy. But you cannot call it a democracy because Israel governs millions of Palestinians under different laws and under a completely different reality. Not just the laws are different, but the actual reality of life, the you know, everything from how much water is allocated to Palestinians, land confiscations, home demolitions, all these different things that are not necessarily you know, they're not necessarily governed by the law, but by policy. And so it is an apartheid regime without any question. When people say democracy, they talk about the privileges that Israeli Jews enjoy as citizens of the state of Israel. Now, again, I'll say what I said earlier. Now, with this particular government, with these racist, you know, uncompromising, zealot, Arab-hating, you know, bloodthirsty radicals that are now in coalition with Netanyahu, many Israelis fear that this might infringe on some of their rights. Part of the issue is the judicial nominations and the entire judicial system. They're not comfortable with the fact that Netanyahu, and he's not the only one, by the way, that is worried about indictment. He's not the only one in the government that is worried about these things. And so this is what's troubling Israelis, that this is going to infringe somehow on their privileges. And again, I'll say what I said earlier, this is going to make the reality for Palestinians far worse than anything we've ever seen before. Now, Israel has been governed by war criminals since it was established, but this is taking it to a whole new level that we've never seen before.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Would you call or describe Netanyahu the same way as you just described his cabinet, by the way?
Oh, without any question. The difference is that Netanyahu is a politician. And, you know, politicians make promises. They lie. Of course, he's a war criminal. There's no question. The people he's aligned himself with this time are zealots. And zealots are far more radical, far more extreme, and far more, willing to execute the promises that they made to their constituents.
Okay. This is another statement coming that happens to fall on you again, Charlotte Cates, from another protester, where he said, we came here to fight for the democracy, which we covered, and we would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world. Now, I'm curious as to why an Israeli would call this cabinet a regime and how the regime would make Israel look dark in the world. What do you think this protester is talking about? What is going on in his mind, you think?
I mean, I guess I would just have to say that that's very much a reflection of the extent to which Zionist lies have completely misdirected any sort of reality. It's kind of like something that happens in the United States frequently, which is that there is, you know, something outrageous that happens, an outrageously corrupt action by a politician or a callous act, you know, by a corporation. And instead of being compared to the numerous other examples in U.S. history where this has occurred, there's a comparison made to, oh, this is like something that would happen in an Asian country or some other country which has, on the balance, been subjected to the same kinds of crimes and attacks by the United States. So it's really quite a racist approach, but it's also somewhat absurd because this isn't a new regime. This isn't a change in the regime. This is simply an uncovering of the regime in front of everybody and the sort of letting it off the leash. It's the same regime, and that regime is Zionist settler colonialism, and it's been an illegitimate regime for 75 years, not just when Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and Netanyahu have taken charge.
Another curious question that comes here to mind, Mikko Pellet, is a protester that went out and made this statement. I'm going to paraphrase it because it's rather lengthy, and come to the end of what this protester said. where he said this can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. And the reference made prior to that is, of course, slamming the cabinet. Why would a protester say that? Do you think that, I mean, does that show how severe these protests are in terms of the kind of trouble that this far-right cabinet, I guess that is called, that it could signal the start of the end of Israel, at least based on this one particular point of view from this protester?
Well, I think, again, I think what the protesters are afraid of is the Israel as they know it. In other words, an Israel where, you know, Israeli Jews have full privileges. And the other aspect is how the world views Israel. And, of course, Israel depends on the international community, particularly the United States and Europe, to support it. And so the fear is, and it's not unsubstantiated, is that because these new faces are now in key positions, they are going to jeopardize, number one, the world supporting Israel, the way the international community supports Israel, and number two, the way Israel is known by, you know, the privileges that are afforded to Israeli Jews as they know them. And so people who oppose Netanyahu, oppose the government, might be arrested. I have to say, though, you know, the rhetoric, even in the Knesset and in the news broadcast in Israel, the rhetoric is far more radical, far more violent.
Give us some examples, can you?
Well, people calling out to arrest the previous prime minister, people calling out to arrest and put on trial for treason, people who are protesting, very clearly saying that, you know, a Jewish murderer, a Jewish, there's no such thing as Jewish terrorism, and that the Palestinian prisoners need to be executed, and so forth. There's a level, although these things have been discussed, but they were fringe. Now they're front and center. And the people that are now in government, of course, are taking up a lot of space within the news, within news broadcasts, within television. And so you hear this far more than you've heard it before, and Israelis are scared, as they should.
Yeah, there's this particular protester, Charlotte Cases, talks about the end of the Jewish state. I can't help but think about or recall what Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, has said. This has been covered, but I have to bring it in to this discussion. Has said that the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. What is the deal with the second half of the eighth decade that Israelis are afraid of? Because it's not just Ehud Barak. You know, we're looking at other Israeli politicians like Naftali Bennett, who has said that, and other Israeli politicians of high stature. What is going on with that? Is there a reason to think that that may come true?
There's a fundamental crisis of the Zionist project that has existed since its inception. I mean, this was the creation of a Zionist state carved out of the Arab world, carved out of the region, in order to represent the interests of imperialism and colonialism in the region, and set up the Zionist settler colonial project at the expense of the Palestinian people. That is a conflict in its very nature that's going to create crisis after crisis after crisis, because it's an illegitimate project that is based solely on colonizing and destroying those that surround it and those that live within that land. And so there is this fundamental crisis that's expressed in Zionism, and that it's reflected through people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, and through the promotion of this idea that Zionism is not what it is in reality. Like, this is a mirror held up to the face of Zionism, and an unwillingness to confront that and say, no, it's possible to have Zionist domination over the majority of the population, but also label that a liberal democracy. Well, what's becoming apparent is that it's no longer possible to hold up that incomparable, that inconsistent reality. And also, I mean, the reality is that Palestinian resistance is getting stronger and stronger. People are continuing to fight back despite all of these enhanced threats, despite the fact that every day there's a new proposal for executing Palestinian prisoners, for stripping citizenship, for finding new ways to imprison Palestinians. People in the resistance are continuing to fight back and to change the equation, to challenge the balance of power.
Michael Pelle, you talked about the Palestinians before, and you said how that this cabinet, far-right cabinet, as it's called and described, is going to come down hard on Palestinians. Pretty evident since the beginning of the year how that has happened. Now, we're looking at a kind of a new frontier when it comes to the Palestinian resistance, and it's these grassroots Palestinians who have no affiliation, as they have stated, to any of the particular well-known resistance groups, of which they have come out against the actions of Israelis. Israeli forces. And one of them is the Den of Lions. It's a particular group that's an independent armed Palestinian group. But you're looking at these grassroots fighters, resistance fighters, I guess. How much of a threat does that pose, a cabinet that you said is bloodthirsty, that is out to get Palestinians?
I don't think the Palestinian resistance poses a threat, certainly not a military threat to Israel. But we do see the things that we're going to see in terms of the lives of Palestinians have to do, I think, more on the issues of the day-to-day policy, land confiscation, home demolition, stripping people of their citizenship, harsher treatment of Palestinians who resist, Palestinians who are part of the. I mean, there's Palestinian resistance all over Palestine all the time. Some of it is military, some of it is armed, some of it is not. Palestinians who are engaged in unarmed resistance and have been under threat of attack against their lives are far more likely now to be killed. And the very essence of life for Palestinians, day-to-day life, for example, Israel created a new ministry called the Development of the Negev and the Galilee, the Nakab and Al-Jalil. And what that means is getting rid of the Palestinian communities who still exist and you know, in large numbers in these communities. The Palestinian Bedouin, for example, the Nakab, there are about 300,000 people living in the southern part of Palestine. They've been treated terribly, you know, throughout the existence of the State of Israel. They are going to see destruction of their communities, destruction of their homes, taking of their lands on a much larger scale. The same thing we're going to see in the Galilee, although in the Galilee they're much more, you know, there's much more wealth,
right,
and it's a different kind of society. But still, we're going to see a lot more of that. And what is an Area C, Palestinians in Area C, again, the building of settlements in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, Silwan, which are two very important neighborhoods, you know, around the old city of Jerusalem, they're going to be demolished. They're going to be destroyed. There's going to be no Palestinian is going to be safe around there. They're going to be building massively for Palestinians. And, of course, for this new government, for these new people, you know, the most important aspect is Al-Aqsa. And they're going to do it as referred to as the Hebronization of Al-Aqsa, which is they're going to allow more and more of these radicals to come and pray. They're going to eventually build some kind of a prayer house for them. And all of this is going to come at the expense of Al-Aqsa, which eventually I think they want to destroy. I don't think.